Bien, je vous propose de démarrer le séminaire et j'ai un grand plaisir aujourd'hui d'accueillir Henrik Herson qui est venu spécialement pour nous du Karolinska Institute. Henrik Herson est maintenant associate professor à l'Institut Karolin donc de Stockholm où il dispose d'un propre groupe de recherche d'une dizaine de personnes et il travaille sur cette question qu'on avait déjà un petit peu abordée avec l'exposé de Olaf Blanke qui est la question de savoir comment nous savons, croyons savoir que nous habitons notre propre corps. Comment on délimite notre corps, comment on pense l'habiter et comment parfois, dans des expériences de sortie du corps, on peut montrer qu'il s'agit d'une construction mentale, ce que Lionel Nakache aurait appelé une fiction, mais une fiction qui, fort heureusement, colle avec la réalité la plupart du temps. So, welcome, Henrik. Thank you for your visit. And just going to read the title of your presentation, The Construction of an Experience of Our Body. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor Dehaene. And thank you to the organizers of the Collège de France. It's a great privilege to be here and talk to you today. So what will I talk about? I will talk about how we come to experience that our consciousness or awareness is located inside our body. How do I know where me stops and the external world starts? These are old philosophical questions, of course. But in my talk here, I will try to present experimental data to show that we can start to address these questions in cognitive neuroscience. So, the problem is then how the brain knows the difference between the self and the world. And this is a fundamental problem in biology. All organisms must have mechanisms to allow this differentiation about the self and the world. Even plants, evidently, plant biologists have told me, plants must know what is a parasite and what is its own sort of body. But here we'll talk today about the mind and consciousness and how our human mind or our perceptual system can make this distinction between me and something that is not me. And this is important. Imagine, for example, a lion hunting a zebra on the savannah, and there's a huge fight. They need to know which is their own body and which is the body of the lion, for example. Now, in cognitive neuroscience, the story really starts in neurology. And many of the early French and German neurologists wrote about this. It's a very strange syndrome. And more recently, Ramachandran and Oliver Sacks have written about these cases in their books. And the story is always the same. The neurologist is going the grand round, and there's a patient, a stroke patient, who had a stroke, typically on the right brain, and that is complaining to the nurses that someone in the night is sneaking into the bed, lying next to them, and they try to throw away this person, but the person keeps coming back. And when the doctor asks what is the problem, the patient will say, you know, this leg here is not mine. It's someone else lying here, and they try to throw the leg out of the bed. So somehow, if you damage frontal or parietal lobes, especially on the right, you can have a breakdown in your normal sense of self or self-perception of the body. But this doesn't tell us exactly what are the mechanism or how is this achieved, because the stroke lesions are always large, they damage several areas, and always damage the underlying white matter connections. So this is very interesting work, but we need to get further if you want to do experiments on body ownership. In psychology, there is a long tradition of thinking about this in terms of what was called in the old literature intermodal perceptual correlations or multisensory correlations. What is this? Well, the idea is very simple, really. It is like if I move my body around, what I see, my impressions to my eyes, and the impressions coming from the skin and the muscle and the joints, all receptors in the body, they all tend to be correlated in a particular way. I move my hand, and that produces visual impressions that are correlated to the tactile and proprioceptive, the position sense information. So maybe the mind could use that to solve problems like this as quickly, as accurately as possible, which is my hand, two surgeons working or a number of surgeons working, you need to identify your hands quickly. So it's a very general idea. And we're going to explore this idea in more detail in this talk in a cognitive neuroscience framework. So this is the outline of my talk. I will try to address or introduce the problem of body ownership as a multisensory problem, because then we can tackle it using various scientific approaches. I will tell you some behavioral evidence from psychology, some neuroscience about particularly brain areas and some of the physiology there that could be very important to understand this problem. Tell you a little bit about brain imaging experiments, where we try to change the feeling of ownership while people, brain activity is being scanned with fMRI. I will tell you a little bit about full body illusions, a little bit like what Ulf Blank is working on, where you can experience that you leave your body completely, maybe swap body with a friend or a colleague or a mannequin. And finally, tell you a little bit, what could be the practical applications of all of this? Is this just fun, philosophy, or could we actually use it for something, for example, in the clinic or in the industry? Okay. Since we're going to try to address the problem of body ownership from a multisensory perspective, what is that? What is this? Well, it's a big field in neuroscience that works on this problem. Problem of multisensory integration. If I put down this bottle of water here on the table, it makes a sound. I can feel the bottle, it makes a sound, and I have the visual impressions of the bottle. And I experience this as one object. And a cat, for example, is very scared of dogs, and it can see a dog, and it can hear a dog. And it's very important for the cat to know exactly where the dog is. And it's been studied now for several decades that the way the cat solves this problem is to combine visual information from the eyes with auditory information from the ears. And there are specific neurons, brain cells, in the midbrain, something called the superior colliculus, that has the capacity to integrate signals from the different senses. For example, this is a visual signal and an auditory signal, and this neuron in the superior colliculus discharges more frequently. It sends many more electronic pulses when you have a combined stimulation. And this is another example from recording from these cells. A visual stimulation gives a small response, an auditory, a large response, and a combined, a huge response. And from this work, it has emerged some principles. This is another example of a multisensory problem, ventriloquism. It's a trick used in Tivolis and circuses and things like that. Maybe some of you have experienced this. This guy here, he's speaking with his belly. He doesn't show it in the mouth so much. And when he speaks, the puppet moves his lips. And what happens is that you start to hear the puppet speaking. The sound you hear seems to come from the lips of the puppet. Very strange. The brain is somehow fusing two sensory modalities, vision and hearing, into one percept, which is a speaking puppet. And we can apply this principle then to the body and the sense of self. So there's three principles I'm going to tell you about because it's going to be important. I'm going to come back to this throughout the talk when we talk about the body. Something called the temporal congruency principle. It's very simple. It's basically that the two signals must happen at the same time. This guy must speak exactly when this puppet moves its lips. If they're out of sync, out of time, you don't get this illusion. It has to be at the same time. There's a spatial congruency principle. The puppet must be quite close to the man here. If you move the puppet up here, this effect will disappear. The signals must come from similar parts of space. I'm not going to talk about this too much, but this is if the signals are noisy, this effect is stronger. And in this case, they are noisy. And one can formalize this problem, for example, in mathematical models. And the problem for the brain here is to determine if this is two different guys, one speaking, one verbally speaking, and one visually speaking, like this. One guy here and one is just a puppet. And there's two signals, an auditory and a visual signals, and they are separate. Or if they actually come from the same source, the puppet. And it's sometimes called the multisensory assignment problems, the causal interference problems. I'm not going to go into detail, but there is a theoretical framework to think about this problem. Now we're going to go back to the body, this problem of how do I know that this is my body? How do I know that this is my hand? And in this case, of course, it's more difficult. And the problem for the brain here is to say whether the hand you see and feel and sense from muscle sense is really the same hand which is yours, or if these signals come from different hands. Don't bind them together. This is another guy and this is you. Keep them apart. Or whether it's one. So, I'll now talk about more recent behavioral experiments of psychology that shows that, yes, somehow this phenomenon of multisensory integration seems to be related to the feeling of owning a body. And about over a decade ago, this very interesting illusion was discovered. It was a party trick, actually, used by students. I think it was in Princeton or Yale, I can't remember. And they were playing around with this. And one of the assistant professors saw this and was very interested in this and wrote up a little paper. And it's quite remarkable. So this is this test subject. He's sitting here. And he's looking at this fake dummy hand, a plastic hand. And the real hand is here, hidden behind the screen, so you can't see it. Then the scientist is simultaneously touching the two hands like this, synchronizing the touches as perfectly as possible. You have to touch on the same parts of the two hands. Now, in the beginning, nothing happens. It's kind of silly. You sit here, this guy's touching your hand, and you look at this piece of rubber. You know, nothing happens. But if you're lucky, after 10, 20, 30 seconds or so, something dramatic typically happens. You can see that on the participant. His eyes, opens up, and he looks at the hand. And what happens is that you start to sense touch here on the rubber hand, where you see it, as if the rubber hand could sense the touch of the paintbrush. And you start to lose awareness of your real hand. It sort of fades away from your awareness. And it feels that this is your hand. And if you move your finger, you're very surprised that the rubber hand doesn't move. It feels like your hand has become paralyzed. And if the scientist is a little bit nasty, like Ramachandran was in one of his earlier experiments, and he took a hammer and attacked the rubber hand, the person will flinch and be upset. Hey, stop that, that's me. So what happens here? Well, you have visual information and tactile information that are temporally congruent, happens at the same time, at a very similar location, and the mind fuses the two into one percept. This is my hand. A little bit similar, like the puppeteer, the ventriloquism effect. But this is for the body, and in a sense more dramatic, because it's the change of who you are. And there's not many ways to measure this illusion. There are several groups that have studied this phenomenon and developed ways to measure it. The easiest way is to ask people, like you do in pain research in the clinic. You ask people, how much pain do you feel? By giving them a visual analog scale, and they have to rate, how strongly do you feel that the rubber hand is your hand? And this produces very, very strong results and consistent results in literature. You can use a bedside trick, similar like neurologists use in the clinic. You can ask the person to, first you induce the illusion, and then you ask the person to close his eye and point to where he feels his hand to be. Now, what happens then is the person tends to point towards the rubber hand rather than the real hand. And the more mispointing, the stronger the illusion. So it's a behavioral measure of the illusion. It's correlated with the illusion. I talked to you that you can attack the rubber hand with a hammer or a needle that we have used in our lab, and you can measure the emotional responses in different ways, how emotionally attached you are to the hand. And there are other more sophisticated tests you can use to show that the rubber hand produces changes in reaction time tasks, experiments by Spence and Driver and colleagues. So it has a consequence in information processing, the somatosensory system. Okay. The next couple of slides, I told you the take-home message already, that it's really the fusion of vision and touch and proprioception. The next couple of slides are a little bit more technical for those of you who are a little bit more experts. So I told you about the temporal congruency principle, right? The signals might happen at the same time. The illusion doesn't work if you touch the rubber hand and the real hand out of phase, out of sync, alternatingly. Then this is just a piece of rubber and your real hand is behind the screen. That is very similar to the temporal congruency principle in multisensory integration. Longer temporal delays break the illusion, which is also consistent with the idea that this involves multisensory integration. The spatial congruency principle seems to also to be in place here. The brush strokes must be applied to the corresponding parts of the two hands. If I touch the index finger of the rubber hand, you must touch the index finger of the real hand. If you touch different parts of the hands, the illusion breaks down. Very simple, obeying the spatial congruency rule. The rubber hand must be anatomically aligned with the hidden hand. So they must have the same orientation as sticking out from your body. If the rubber hand is rotated like this, which is an experiment from Patrick Haggerty and his colleagues in London, the illusion doesn't work. It looks like the rubber hand is pointing your direction, and even if you touch the two hands synchronously, nothing happens. Again, a match between vision and proprioception in this case. This is even more interesting, perhaps. It deals with what kind of reference frame or coordinate system is used, and how far and how, which where in space this spatial congruency principle is defined. So the rubber hand must be placed close to the real hand. If you move the rubber hand further away, outside your reaching distance, for example, the illusion breaks down. It seems to require that the rubber hand is in near personal space, within about a meter or some so. And I will come back to that, because that's actually an important observation. It also so that the direction of the brush strokes on the two hand must be spatially congruent in a coordinate system that is hand-centered. Now, what is that? A little bit technical. Well, it means that if you put the rubber hand here and the real hand here, and if you stroke the two hands in this direction, same time but in this different direction, you get no illusion, because they are not in isodirectional, they're not in the same direction with respect to the hand. Now, if you rotate the real hand like that, you see the direction of the strokes are now the same direction from the hand's perspective, and you get an illusion. But actually, these strokes in external space, allocentric space, are not congruent. And if you have this situation where the direction of the strokes are actually identical in absolute external space, but they are different in hand space, hand-centered space, you don't get the illusion. It's another beautiful experiment from Patrick Haggerty's group in London. Okay, I talked about experimental psychology. So the rubber hand illusion seems to obey some rules, spatial rule and temporal rule, that seem to determine when you feel that the rubber hand is yours and when it's not yours. How can we think in terms about this? How can we think about this problem in terms of the brain? Because that is what cognitive neuroscience is about, this taking psychology seriously and taking the brain science seriously. So when we started thinking about this, there was an obvious candidate. And these are brain cells that was first reported by Risolati and colleagues in Parma in a paper. Cells that have very interesting properties. These are neurons that can be found in the premotor cortex and in the posterior parietal cortex. And these cells, if you put in an electrode in the brain of the monkey in this area, this cell will be active when you touch the monkey's hand or when the monkey sees an object close to the hand, approaching the hand. So here, Risolati and colleagues draw on the monkey where these cells will discharge. So for example, this cell will be active if you touch the monkey's hands or the lips, or a monkey sees an object approaching the lips. And this neuron is active when you touch the monkey's hands or the monkey sees an object near the hands. So these cells can combine vision and touch. Single neurons have this capacity to perform multisensory integration. And these areas receive anatomical connections from the visual brain, the early visual areas, and the early somatosensory areas. There's been many more studies. These neurons can be found in a number of regions. I talked about the premotor cortex. It's been most studied. It's actually the posterior part of the premotor cortex. Many of you might have heard about the famous mirror neurons. The mirror neurons are actually more anterior here, in the more anterior part of the premotor cortex. And these multisensory neurons are much more numerous, 5 to 10 times more numerous. And they can also be found in the interparietal cortex and in the afferparietal cortex and in the putamen. And these are other examples of the properties of these neurons. So this neuron, for example, is active with the monkey seeing object near the face and when you touch the monkey's face. Or this neuron, for example, you touch the monkey's shoulder and the monkey seeing object is approaching the shoulder. It's like it creates a map, a multisensory map of space near the body, which is labeled peripersonal space, or a more simple word might be near personal space, space around the body, which is very important for behavior, of course. You need to defend the body. If a sharp object is approaching yourself, you must be able to defend yourself. Or if you interact with objects in the world, you need to have such a system. And this system has been studied very extensively by Graziano and his colleagues. And they have shown that the neurons in these areas, they encode these stimuli in body part-centered coordinates, in coordinate systems that are centered on specific body parts. So if the monkey moves its arm, the so-called receptive fields, the visual receptive fields, move along with the hand. So they encode multi-sensory integration of visual-tactile responses in body part-centered reference frame, very similar to what I told you about the psychology results on the rubber hand illusion. That seems to obey the same rules. So we can find the same principles in these neurons, in the pattern of responses in these neurons, and in the psychology data from the rubber hand illusion. So we started to think, okay, these two things could be related. Maybe this could be actually a mechanism of body ownership, and it could be in a very simple explanation for this phenomenon. I can skip that. One can also see these responses. This is a very technical point, but one can see these responses in sleeping monkey, in anesthetized monkey. So it's not just that the monkey is preparing to do something. It seems these responses are sensory in nature also. Because, of course, the areas of the premotor cortex, intraparietal cortex that we're talking about are very important for action, for controlling the body. And that is perfectly fine from our perspective, because there are sensory responses here. And the experts of multisensory integration, like Barry Stein, for example, he has always emphasized that the whole purpose of multisensory integration is to drive adaptive behavior. So defense reaction and sense of your body could be very linked in this system. Multisensory integration properties have also been seen in the parietal cortex. This neuron can show so-called super-additive effects. So if you touch the hand in full view, you get a much stronger response than if you only see an object or if you only touch the hand where the person has their eyes closed. Another example of multisensory integration. Okay, I'll move on. So the next step is then to scan people, put people in a brain scanner, like this, magnetic resonance imaging. You can register the activity in every area of the brain with a great, good resolution, 3 by 3 by 3 millimeter, as normal healthy individuals lie there and experience these dramatic changes in body ownership, in self-perception of the body. For example, with the rubber hand. And what we measure is changes in the oxygenation of the blood that is related to the overall activity of a group population of neurons. And we can try to link changes in self-perception with brain activity directly. So the first question is, okay, I told about monkeys and I told about rubber hand experiments in humans. Do we even know that humans have a similar system in the brain for multisensory integration? Is the human premotor cortex, intraparietal cortex similar? So we've done some experiments to test that. So very simple to the monkey experiments. The person is lying in the scanner, he looks at the hand, and we can touch the hand, or we can place an object near the hand like this. So here we touch the person's finger, and we can register responses in the brain, and the person can see an object approaching the hand but not touching it. And then we can also touch the hand. And then we can just map out the very basic multisensory properties of these areas, tactile responses and visual responses. And these are areas of convergence, areas that both respond to a scene, a touch, or a sight of an object near the body, and a touch stimulation, like the ventral premotor cortex and dorsal premotor cortex, areas in the intraparietal cortex and the inferior parietal cortex. Very similar to the monkey literature. So luckily for us, the human brain seem to behave similarly, like in macaque monkeys. Here's another data showing that areas in the premotor cortex, in the parietal cortex, show stronger responses than the stimulation of isolated modalities. Again, an example of these areas have the capacity to perform multisensory integration. But this is not really what we're interested in here. We're interested in relating this to the rubber hand illusion. And this is just an experiment. I will just very briefly mention this experiment, because it also shows that these areas respond specifically to stimuli near the body. So if you show an object further away, they don't respond. So this area seems to be sensitive to stimulation in near personal space. But this is the more important part. Now we try to really test the idea that the changes in body ownership is related to activity in these areas, related to the multisensory integration. So a few years ago, my colleagues in London, we did this experiment where we put people in the brain scanner. They could look at the rubber hand with direct vision, and this is the real hand. And then we could simultaneously touch the two hands to induce the illusion. Whereas controls, we could just touch the two hands alternatingly or rotate the rubber hand 180 degrees. That also breaks the illusion. That means that we can isolate activity that is specifically related to the feeling that the rubber hand is yours. And we then violate the temporal and spatial congruency principles. So we're sort of basically testing the idea that these two principles are in play here. If you ask people how strongly they feel the rubber hand illusion, this is the blue, they get much stronger responses in the synchronous temporal and spatially congruent condition than in the control conditions, so-called significant interaction. And this was the experimental paradigm, so people just lying there in the scanner. They don't do anything, really. Just look at the rubber hand. They brush the hand. They start feeling the illusion. The only thing they had to do was to press the foot pedal once the illusion started so that we know that they experienced the illusion and they were not sleeping. And here, in this illusion period, they really were not allowed to do anything because we wanted to have very clean data, not contaminated with the person making a decision or moving. And then when we compare then the illusion condition to the controls, we found a significant interaction in two key areas related to multisensory integration. The bilateral premotor cortex, the ventral part, shown on these two slides. This is the front of the brain, this is the back of the brain, top and the lower part. And a very similar location in the inferior part of the precentral sulcus and the precentral gyrus, fitting very well with the monkey data. We saw these responses that was greatest in the illusion condition than in the controls. Significant interaction. And this is a very similar response was seen in the interparietal cortex, with the greatest response in the illusion condition. So just as like people's perception of the rubber hand changes when it violates these rules of the illusion, we can see the same mirroring of the neural responses in these areas. And those people who've reported the strongest illusion, and we asked them to fill in the questionnaire, also were those that tend to show the greatest responses in the premotor cortex. Again, linking this activity to perception. So the idea could be that when you start in the beginning, you have your receptive field, visual receptive field, centered on the rubber hand, and when you touch there, and you see the touch here, the visual stimuli is outside the receptive field of the hand. When the rubber hand illusion kicks in, you will have an alignment of what you see and what you feel. You'll activate these premotor neurons and parietal neurons, and you get a match, a perceptual binding of vision, touch, and proprioception. It could be mediated by these neurons. It's a very, very simple explanation, but simple explanations are often good in science to start with. Okay. Now, this effect doesn't depend on vision. It's nothing special about vision. It's the meaningful correlations that matters. So to show that, we developed a non-visual version of the rubber hand illusion here. So now the test person is blindfolded and is touching a rubber hand here. And I'm helping subject to move the finger, so subject's finger is passive. And every time she touched the knuckle of the rubber hand, I touch her knuckle here. Again, the first 10, 30 seconds, you don't feel anything. You feel that you are touching a hard, cold rubber hand knuckle here, and that someone is touching your other hand over here. When the illusion kicks in, you feel suddenly that you are touching your hand directly. It feels a little bit hard and cold, but it's your hand. The time course and the questionnaire data is very similar to the visual rubber hand illusion, so we think it could be similar processes involved. When we scan people, we got the same result, basically activity in the premotor cortex and interparietal cortex. That was the greatest in the illusion condition. This time again, we violated the temporal congruency by touching the two hands alternatingly, didn't produce a response, or we replaced the rubber hand with something that really didn't feel like a rubber hand at all. We took a dish brush, so when I touched the dish brush, it just doesn't feel like a hand. So it's violated the congruency of the tactile feelings of the two hands. Okay. Now, sometimes when I talk in America, people are a little bit skeptic, and they think, well, maybe this is just, you know, a change in position sense. You feel that your hand is closer to the rubber hand, and that's all there is to it. Very similar to something called prism adaptation. When you give people funny glasses that change the visual world, they tend to change the perceived location of a hand. We don't think it's that simple, and there are many reasons for that. You can have large shift in proprioception, position sense, without changes in ownership. The changes in position sense can start before you start experience any ownership. And we scan people, for example, and looked at the activity before the illusion starts. And this is for the first 10 seconds, where we brush the two hands and they don't feel any illusion. It's just a piece of rubber. And then there is activity in areas that are related to arm reaching and proprioception, very similar to prism adaptation literature. In the cerebellum, the dorsal premotor cortex, and supplementary motor area. And different sites in the premotor and intraparietal cortex. And this activity correlates with the proprioceptive drift. So we think that the changes in just perceived location of the arm is part of the phenomenon, but it can't explain. Can't explain changes in ownership. We think you need to have the meaningful correlations on multiple senses. Another objection was, well, maybe is the rubber hand really becoming part of you? You know, maybe it's some visuotactile trick, if you like, but not really becoming part of you. And some thinkers, for example, Damasio, have suggested that the emotional system is very important for having a sense of self. So we thought we're going to look a little bit more into that by having this paradigm where you attack the rubber hand. You induce the illusion that the rubber hand is yours, and then you attack it with a needle to see if the emotional brain now starts to monitor the sort of physiological well-being of the rubber hand, which would be good objective evidence for the illusion. So again, we reproduce the same experiment, put people in the scanner, induce the illusion of ownership by touching the two hands synchronously, or no ownership by touching the two hands alternatingly. And then we have these small mini blocks where we use a needle to sort of threaten the rubber hand, move the needle very close to the hand. And that's scary to people. And the stronger they feel the illusion, the stronger they tell us that they are scared in the ratings, in the questionnaire ratings. And if you look into the brain, we could see that too. So we saw when in the illusion condition, we saw strong responses in parts of the brain that are related to pain anticipation. Exactly those regions that light up when people expect to be hurt. And the stronger they reported that they felt ownership of the rubber hand, the stronger was these threat-evoked responses in the emotional brain, which we think is a strong objective evidence that yes, the hand is really becoming, the artificial hand is really becoming part of you. And that the effect generalizes to different cognitive, systems in the brain. And we can also see, for example, that the stronger the activity in the premotor cortex, the stronger the threat-evoked responses in one of these areas, in the insula. That is just reflecting exactly what the people are telling us. And this is one other point now, because in the next part of my talk, we will actually use this threat procedure as an objective measure of owning a body. And we think that is very good for many reasons, because part of the reasons why ownership would exist in the first place is to defend the body. And these emotional responses are then linked to the multisensory responses. Okay. So a very, very simple, cartoonish, very preliminary model would be that, okay, here I walk around in the room, and my early visual and somatosensory areas are bombarded by data all the time. And the problem for the brain is to try to bind this information together. And there's a continuous comparisons in association cortex, for example, in the posterior parietal cortex, intraparietal cortex. If there's mismatches, there's a recalibration process that starts. Changes in position sense, sort of internal representation of where the hand is. And in the case of the rubber hand illusion, these discrepancies are large. And the recalibration is very extensive. And you have to brush the two hands for 10, 30 seconds sometimes to recalibrate the system. And then when you have a match between what you see, what you feel, and the touches on the skin, you get great responses in the premotor cortex and intraparietal cortex also. And that could be an internal signal for the brain that this is your hand. It just feels like your hand. You have a perceptual binding. The effect generalizes to the emotional brain, because now you start caring about the rubber hand. It generalizes to the prefrontal cortex and the speech centers, because you can tell the scientists, you know, it really feels like my hand. It's crazy. All right. I'm just going to cover a couple of slides to illustrate, you know, this remarkable case of construction, because there's some kind of construction process here. The brain must try to fit these pieces of information together. So how far can we take that? What happens if you present the brain with an impossible scenario, a situation that is can't be solved? Could we have an illusion of having three arms, you know, an extra arm sticking out here? It seems to be the case. So in this three-arm illusion, the person is sitting here, and now we put two rubber hands. These are two artificial hands in front of the person. And the real hand is hidden here, under the table, like this. And you just see these two rubber hands. And we're very careful to put the real hand just in the middle here, below the two hands, and there's an equal distance to each rubber hand. And then we construct this double brush. So we stroke both hands at the same time, and then every time we stroke the two rubber hands, we touch the real hand in the same part here. So there is a spatial congruency, there is a temporal congruency, there is a spatial congruency of vision and proprioception. It's only these strange things that you have two hands. And what happens here is you start to feel touches on both hands. It's like both rubber hand senses the touches, like both hands are your hands. And we can measure that by threatening the two rubber hands with a needle, and people are more afraid. They sweat more when we do that than in the control condition with asynchronous stimulation. We need to do more experiments about this, but what we think is going on here is that you create a situation like this, where you have two equally probable scenarios. This is equally probable to be your hand like this. So the brain can't match this very easily here, vision, tact, touch, and proprioception. Instead, it's fitted to two hands that are sort of both your hands, but to a lesser degree. So we would predict that you have half a hand here and half a hand here, so that you have like a probability distribution with two peaks. This is likely to be my hand, this is likely to be my hand. And we can do experiments to test this idea. But it shows that the brain has to piece this different information together in sort of an active interpretation process that we need to study much more carefully. Okay. Now, I'll talk about whole bodies. Now, can we make illusions where people leave their body to be outside themselves? Maybe something similar to what Olof Blanke and Brugger in Switzerland have been studying for years, out-of-body experiences. This has been described in the clinic. I will not repeat Blanke's talk. I will just show you this slide, which was very inspiring to us, where he found that in a patient, if he stimulated part of the posterior parietal cortex, this was a patient who had a tumor and had to be awake during surgery before they could remove the tumor. And as a standard procedure, they put electrodes in different parts of the cortex to stimulate, to make sure they didn't damage language areas. But then they found that when they stimulate here, the person described something like this, a sense of rotation, floating, or moving up from their body, somehow leaving the body. And there are many such cases that Blanke has described, and they have a couple of common features that you feel that you're outside yourself, you look at yourself from a different perspective. So you have many of these people describe that they have an illusory body, or not no body, but often an illusory body, and that is outside the physical body. So we were inspired by this. We were also very inspired by some thinkers in psychology and philosophy, like Gibson and Ernst Mach before him, who emphasized that the first-person perspective is very important for sense of body self. The first-person perspective, what is that? Well, that's the normal way I look at my body, right? My eyes sit here on the skull. They always sit here. They don't move around. I'm not a crab who can move my eyes. So they always sit here, and I almost used to see the body from this perspective. This is Gibson lying on the sofa with his feet, his hands, a little cigarette, and he wrote the whole chapter about this. He thought that this was important. And Mark II. So what would happen if I could just take my eyes now and move them around in the room? Maybe take them down and sit next to you there, and I would see myself standing up here. Would my consciousness now move with the eyes or stay in my body? Or if I could take my eyes and put them on my belly here, would my sense of consciousness and self move down into the belly? Well, these are thought experiments. But they're to illustrate that the first-person perspective is probably important. So we thought we have to include that if we want to start experiments with full-body illusions. So this is what we did. We couldn't move people's eyes surgically, but we can use simple technology. A couple of cameras hooked up to these head-mounted displays, two little screens, so you can see yourself from the back. So this is a reporter we tried this on. So he sees this. He sees himself sitting in front there, and he sees me touching a pen towards the cameras. And every time I do that, note the synchronicity, I touch his chest at the same time. Now, he should sit still, he shouldn't move. But this illusion is so strong that you can reproduce it in individual reporters. And what happened here? Well, I'm standing here in the beginning of the experiment, and the person comes in, sits down in the middle of the testing room. And he knows I'm standing behind him. And when I began to, then I began to touch his chest, he can't see that. And then he sees himself from the back, and he sees the hand moving towards the cameras. In the beginning, he still knows he's looking at himself here, but quite very, very quickly, you start to feel that, you are sitting here, and that I'm standing in front of you, and that I'm touching your chest directly. And that this guy over here in the middle of the room is some kind of other person, a different person, or an empty shell, or a physical body, or a mannequin. So you feel that you now have, you're sitting in the back of the room, and this is no longer yourself. You have to touch the two bodies, the real body and the phantom body, synchronously. If I do the touches alternatingly like this, the illusion doesn't work. So it seems to also to be depend on the multi-sensory integration principles. Now we can test this. How do we test this? Well, it's a very strong illusion. We can give people a questionnaire. We can also test it on people like this. This is a reporter from BBC who said that if he didn't experience anything, he could not lie to the viewers. And then we test it like this by first inducing the illusion, and then we sort of attack his illusory body. And then he responded like this. And we don't need to put people in the brain scanner all the time to measure the activity in their emotional brain, fear. And or pain anticipation. We can also put electrodes on the skin and measure something which is called a skin conductance response. Because if you have a strong fear response that something is damaging to you, you will start to sweat. And we can measure that with these electrodes. That's an objective measure of fear or pain anticipation. This is just data from a group of people that came into the lab. We didn't tell them anything. We just put them in this situation, threaten the body with a hammer after periods of synchronous or asynchronous condition, when everything is controlled, and they are more fearful here. So this is not like watching a scary movie, because it's kind of scary just to watch at this. But this response is much stronger when you actually feel that this is your body, it's really here, and this hammer really comes into your near personal space. And then we think it's this older brain system takes over, because now you're under real threat. These are some new experiments that a master student did in the lab this summer when we start to attack the real body, the empty shell, if you like. So now you feel that you're over here and that this is someone else. And then when we threaten the real body, you are less afraid in the illusion condition than in the asynchronous control condition. It's further evidence that this illusion is sort of real. Now, a student of mine, Valeria Petko, have done a series of experiments with full body. And now she puts moves the sense of self into a mannequin, like this. So we put the cameras now on the head of the mannequin, and this is a test person, and we ask the test person to look down. And when he looks down, he doesn't see himself, he sees the mannequin, because he connects the cameras to the head-mounted displays. So this is what you see. And then Valeria simultaneously touches the two bodies.
I think he just saw that there. Just like the rubber hand illusion.
And then we can test if, and what happens then? Well, people start to feel that this mannequin is their own body. Not only just a hand, but the whole mannequin, the belly, the feet, the arms, and so on. And even if you are a woman, you will accept the male mannequin's body, just like that. Or if you have a different body shape, if you're a bit, corpulent, a bit round, it feels like it's your body, no problem. Because we think that these neurons up there in the premotor intraparietal cortex, they don't care about what the body looks like. They try to localize the body in space, and then these fine-grained details doesn't matter if you're a man or woman. And this is how we can test this. We can attack the mannequin with a knife, like this. And then when you feel that this is you, you respond much more stronger than if you don't feel it's you. And we can use a spoon as the control. And you get these evoked responses in skin sweating, just in the illusion condition, but not in the different controls. And we can show that this effect generalizes. We're not just studying the rubber belly, because if you saw that Valeria was touching the belly of the mannequin, the effect generalizes to other body parts. So if you touch the belly and then threaten the hand, or vice versa, we get the same results. So it's like ownership now spreads from the stimulated body parts to all the parts of the body, which is an interesting difference from the rubber hand illusion. Now, you have to have a human-like body. It doesn't seem to work if you take something that doesn't look like a human at all. Now, we should try more things, but we tried a wooden table because it was claimed by a famous neurologist that you can actually become a table. So what we did was that we just reproduced the experiment exactly the same, but now we have a mannequin or a table. But look, when we use a table, we get no responses. People, they really don't care. It doesn't matter if you touch the two objects synchronously or asynchronously. Again, we can reproduce the results when we use a mannequin. So we think we need to have these cells that are trying to map the body space, they need to be anchored on body parts. They are body part-centered neurons. So it makes sense. They can't center the receptive fields here because it's just an object that really doesn't look like you. What would happen if you took a monkey or a chimpanzee? We don't know. But I think it would work because it has sufficiently similar body plan. Now, another thing we have to prove is the visual perspective. I showed you that picture of Gibson lying on his sofa and the first-person perspective. That was important. We need to test that directly. So we did an experiment where we reproduced everything, the normal setup where you look down at the mannequin, or an experiment where you stand up and you look at the mannequin 1.5 meters in front of you in far extrapersonal space. And then we apply synchronous stimulation and the knife threat. But the illusion only seemed to work if you look down on the body from a first-person perspective. Then you get a significant difference between synchrony and asynchrony. When you look at the mannequin in far extrapersonal space, outside near-personal space, you don't get any significant difference. And it doesn't feel that it's your body anymore, introspectively. And we can also demonstrate that the illusion works also without the video technology. This is something, there's nothing magical in putting on the goggles that some computer scientists have suggested to us. You can reproduce these effects without virtual reality. So this is the mannequin. We just took a normal shop mannequin and took off the head. Another person is lying on a bed like this. And we place the mannequin on top of the test person. So when you look down, you see like this mannequin body. And then we can reproduce the illusion. It works very well. But only when you look down on the mannequin like this, not when you look at the mannequin lying on another bed outside your reaching space, and you see the mannequin like a different person, the illusion doesn't work. Again, this fits with the idea that maybe the mechanisms of body ownership really operates in these hand-centered reference frames and near personal space. And again, this is the data, when the physiological data, when we attack the two mannequins, we get no responses, no results and no difference for the third-person perspective. But in the first-person perspective, we get very significant differences. Okay. I will just very, very briefly mention some brain imaging experiments we have done. They basically show the same thing. And so this is the first experiment. We have now people lying in the scanner, and they see a mannequin or a block of wood. And they're now looking down, looking like this in these head-mounted displays. And we can show the movies of a mannequin or a block of wood. And then the student can be in the scanner room and touch the person's real body synchronously or asynchronously, you know, violating the temporal rule. We can present different objects. And we predicted, of course, that these neurons in the intraparietal and premotor cortex should be involved here as well, because the psychology suggests so to us. So this is the results. So again, we saw activity in the bilateral premotor cortex and intraparietal cortex, which is much stronger in the body synchronous condition than all the controls, asynchrony or wood. This is a significant interaction, which is very strong evidence that this activity is really relating to the binding of vision and touch in body-centered reference frames. And Valeria, who was the first author of this study, could reproduce this. Several times in this experiment, she changed the orientation of the mannequin, first-person perspective, or as third-person perspective, you look at the mannequin like a different person. Synchronous, asynchronous, you got the same results. Activity in the bilateral premotor cortex, intraparietal cortex, where these multisensory neurons exist. Significant interaction. And the stronger the activities in these areas, the stronger the person told us after the experiment that, yes, the mannequin really felt like my body. Again, a correlation between perception, introspective perception, if you like, and activity that we can measure with fMRI. Now, we were interested also, what is the difference between the rubber hand illusion and this full body illusion? I mean, are they just the same, or could there be some differences? Well, the generalization of ownership across the body is important. In the full body illusion, you feel that the whole body is yours, and this effect spreads from the stimulated body parts to all the parts of the body. So we did an experiment where we, you know, induced delusion by stimulating the belly or the hand. And in this case, I'm not going to go into the details, but the control condition where we took away the body altogether, just a hand in empty space that doesn't produce a full body illusion. And again, we could see the same activity in the ventral premotor cortex in the intraparietal cortex, regardless if we induced the illusion by hand stimulation or belly stimulation. This is belly, this is hand. And there was an interesting overlap region. Voxels that didn't care how you started the illusion. Maybe this is something to do with the generalization of ownership. Because if you go back to the monkey literature and look a little bit more careful at those receptive fields, they don't just map hand or face or individual body parts. Many neurons have very large receptive fields. Like a single neuron can respond if your hand is touched or your belly is touched, or if your feet is touched or hand is touched, or even some neurons, like Graziano described, that respond to the whole body. So there also seems to be a convergence of information across body parts, and we think that these responses here could reflect that, and that could be a mechanism for the generalization of ownership to the entire body. Okay, I will move on. Okay, so I'm just going to conclude here, because I presented some unpublished data. So let's read to you the conclusions that we conclude that visual information from the first-person perspective in conjunction with spatially and temporally congruent tactile proprioceptive and visual signal in egocentric reference frames are necessary and sufficient factors to elicit a sense of ownership of the entire body. And I talked to philosopher Thomas Metzinger, and he did not think that this was an exaggeration, so I kept it there, even though it's a very strong claim. And then our fMRI results suggest that the key neural mechanism is the integration of vision and somatic signals in body part-centered reference frame by multisensory neural repopulations in premotor intraparietal cortex. This is very technical for those of you who are not experts, but it basically just puts down what I told you, the whole lecture to words. And importantly, these multisensory mechanisms operate in parallel for different body parts with this functional interplay or generalization between body parts. Okay, I got 6 more minutes to try to convince you that all this research actually is worth the taxpayers' money, that we can actually use it for something. And I'm just going to give you a couple of examples. In engineering, in information technology area, there is a very big interest in trying to use these rules of body ownership to try to enhance virtual reality applications. For example, in virtual reality, you have these very advanced goggles, and you can see simulated worlds. If you look down, you can see a virtual body. In this experiment, you're sitting on the chair, and you can move around freely your head. And there's a woman standing in front of you, and you're a girl sitting in the chair, and you can look around in the room. And as you move your head, the visual impression moves with you. So now you move away from the girl and look into a mirror where you see yourself sitting here. This is work done by Mel Slater in Barcelona, in the EU project that I was involved with also. So here you see yourself in the mirror, and they try to make the correlations always matching, so that when you move, there's always a match between what you see and what you feel. And notice that this woman is touching you on the shoulder, and every time that touch is delivered, you feel touch on your shoulder. So trying to reproduce the full body illusion that I've been told you about. This study is actually now published last year in PLOS One by Mel Slater. Okay, so the idea here is that man can enhance present-day virtual reality application to create more realistic applications, where you really have a strong illusion that you are this virtual body. It's not just like a movie in a computer game, but you have a full-blown body illusion. That could be used, for example, in therapy of spider phobia. They use virtual reality to try to treat spider phobia. So you go into this virtual world, put on the goggles, you see a spider. It's kind of scary, but it's even more scary if you feel that you are this virtual body and the spider is coming close to your hand. So it could be more effective treatment. Another area is try to project the feeling of ownership to advanced prosthetic limbs. This is an advanced robotic hand that was built in Pisa, and this is a work we did together with the hand surgeon team in Lund. And this idea here is that the patient has lost an arm in an accident and is trying to control this robotic hand by contracting the muscles of the shoulder. You can just measure that activity with small electrodes there. It's a training process. You have to train quite a lot. And patients often get a little bit bored. You're trying to control a very advanced tool here. So these people in Lund, they came to me and said, maybe we could use your rubber hand trick to get the amputee to feel that this is really their own hand. Like, this is really part of themselves. Of course, the physiotherapist thought this could be helpful and make the hand more useful. And I was very skeptical. I thought, look, if in the normal rubber hand, you have, if you touch the rubber hand on the index finger, you must touch the person's real hand on the index finger. I mean, it has to be absolutely the same parts of the hands. Now, look, I'm touching here this prosthetic limb here on the index finger, but this is an amputee. He doesn't have a hand. Where can I brush? You know, it is the only stump here. If this was a normal person, it would never work if I brushed a person on the upper arm and the rubber hand's index finger. But then we came to think about some of these very dramatic cases that Ramachandran has been described in his books, that these patients have this peculiar thing, that they have maps on the stump. Now, what is that? First of all, they can experience, they can sense their missing hand. Like 98 or 99% of amputees will still feel their missing hand. They will have a phantom hand, sometimes very vivid. And the neural origin of this is unknown. But this is even more perhaps puzzling. They have a map on the stump. So if I touch this person on these different parts here, they will experience these touches not on the stump, but out in the fingers of the phantom hand. It's called referred sensations. Sometimes they feel double touch. So, and these have a map. So if I touch them here, the person will say, ah, now you touched my thumb, ah, index finger, now the long finger, and so on. Very peculiar. We thought, okay, we don't know exactly how this happens in the brain, but maybe we can use this to get the rubber hand illusion going. So we brush right here on the map that elicits sensations in the index finger of the phantom, you know, the non-existing hand, and then we brush the index finger of the rubber hand. And that seems to work. That seems to produce quite a strong rubber hand illusion in many of these patients. And there's ways to improve the match here, because sometimes when you stroke them here, it doesn't really feel exactly the same direction and so on. But by matching fine adjustments, one can make the illusion even stronger. And of course, we work with clinicians and so on, and the amputees want to be very helpful, and they want to experience the illusion and so on. So we have to have these objective measures. So we induce the illusion, brushing them on the stump, and then we ask them to close their eyes and point to where they feel their hands to be. And then they point more to the rubber hand. Or we can attack the rubber hand as before with a needle, and we can see that they're actually more afraid when that happens after a period of synchronous stimulation than after a period of asynchronous stimulation. So these are some optimistic, positive pilot data that suggest that maybe we can use the principles that we have learned from studying the rubber hand illusion to apply that to advanced prosthetics and make them feel more like really part of you. Which could be very useful for these people. Okay, I will summarize my talk. It's exactly 12 o'clock. So I've been talking about the problem of body ownership and have tried to suggest, it's an hypothesis, that maybe one can explain it within a multisensory framework in terms of multisensory integration mechanisms. And that the perceptual rules or the natural constraints of the rubber hand illusion, the full body illusion, seems to obey these principles of multisensory integration. And the activity in multisensory areas seems to mirror these perceptual changes. So the activity here also seems to obey these multisensory rules. And that makes multisensory integration an interesting candidate mechanism for body ownership. Of course, ideally, we need to go back to animals and record from cells to test this idea and more precisely. And then we think that applying these rules, we can have a number of nice, interesting applications in virtual reality and prosthetics. And this is our research group at the Karolinska Institute here in the Department of Neuroscience, where we study different aspects of body self-perception. And if there are any students here, we're looking for more team members in our group. And the research is funded by the European Research Council, the Human Frontier Science Program, James MacDonald Foundation, the Swedish Foundation for Strategic Research. We also work in Stockholm Brain Institute. And thank you for your attention. Thank you. Oh, thank you.